Blog Talk Radio.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright sunshiny day. Gonna be
good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. Before I introduce my very special guest for tonight, I just want to make a couple of short announcements. We are now in the planning stages for our next healing weekend, which will happen at the end of April of 2017, and it's going to be here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So if you're interested, please email me at bonkaye@aol.com, and I'll be happy to put you on my mailing list and information list as this event is going to be planned. It's the most exhilarating experience going to a healing weekend because you meet lots of other women who are traveling your road or in different phases of the road. And it just seems that when you come out of one of these weekends, you just feel so energized and refreshed. So that's why we keep having them every year and meeting wonderful straight sisters like yourselves and just having a wonderful time of bonding, sharing, caring, crying, laughing, and having some wonderful speakers who can help guide us for the future days ahead. Also, I just wanted to say that tonight I'm very excited to have a very special guest who's been a guest on my show before and who I've actually had the pleasure of meeting in person. And I asked Patsy Ray Dawson to join me tonight. We've had a number of letters from women who are part of the Christian community, members who are in part of our Straight Wives Support Network, who really need guidance. And as I'm very honest with all of you, I'm not really good at giving Christian guidance because I'm Jewish. But Patsy Ray, she is my Christian mentor here. So Patsy Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am tickled to be here, Bonnie, and get to visit with you.
Same here, Patsy. You know, because I'll tell you something, through the years since we first met, and it's been a number of years since we first came in contact with each other, I've really learned so much from you, and you've really opened my eyes to a lot of different things, not just about Christianity and this whole situation, but just in general about empowering women and as far as explaining to women why all of this kind of ties in together, whether it's a biblical tie-in or just a humanistic tie-in. When you're in an unhealthy relationship, then something has to be done about it. And I know that you work with lots of kinds of unhealthy relationships, not necessarily this kind all the time, although you have women who are part of this network also. But in general, you know, you are wonderful as far as breaking some of those religious myths. In fact, I'm surprised that you haven't become the target of a number of churches around the country or the world. Or maybe you are ducking low, maybe. Because you really biblically come up with these wonderful solutions to so many people's problems. And maybe you can give people a little bit of background about yourself and how this all started.
Well, I've been doing this about 40 years, and I got started when my friend, a young bride, and we associated with a young couple, and this husband was abusive towards his wife. I realize now he's very narcissistic, but I didn't know that word back then. And he started using me as a shining example for his wife. And he said, "Why aren't you ever quiet like Patsy's quiet? Or why don't you ever fix farmer's breakfast with ham and biscuit and eggs and gravy?" And yet the amount of money he gave her to spend on groceries, she couldn't even buy napkins. And this went on for a while, and my husband would even say, "Wow, I don't see how she stands him." And then one day he came over to the house, and he said, "Patsy, if a husband tells his wife she ought to eat beans 7 days a week, don't you think she ought to eat beans 7 days a week?" Well, I didn't have to be very smart to know he wanted me to say something that he could use to browbeat her. So I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that." And I knew that the only answer I could give him was a Bible answer to stop him from using me and maybe to help protect my friend. And up at that time, I had been told that the Bible didn't say very much about women, just a few scattered verses here and there. But we were in a real good learning situation. We were taking some Bible classes where they were actually designed to teach men to become preachers. So they were college-level Bible classes. And I learned how to look up the Greek words. I learned how to study. I learned how to go into the context and the history. And I started studying. And as I studied, I found out that the Bible had a tremendous amount to say about women and marriage. I learned that I wasn't practicing some of those things. So I got busy changing my behavior. I got excited about what the Bible said about women and marriage, and I tell my friends, "Guess what I found in the Bible, and it works." And they would get excited about applying it to their lives, and they'd come back and say, "Well, what about this?" And I say, "Well, I don't know, never thought about it." And I had been teaching some classes for a while, and a lady said, "I have this friend who said she doesn't love her husband anymore. Can a woman learn to love her husband again?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And I started really studying about sex. And back at these times, you know, you kind of went into the bookstore and kind of tried to casually get a book, not be very obvious. I mean, this was a very taboo topic.
Right.
The first time I taught a class and talked about the differences between a clitoral and a vaginal orgasm, I got so embarrassed I could hardly speak. Afterwards, the preacher's wife that was there was also a surgical nurse, and she said, I couldn't believe, I just wondered, what in the world were you trying to say? And then when you said it, I thought, is that all? And I realized those were just medical terms to her, but I had never said them out loud before. And the next week I went back and I asked the women, I said, "If I beat around the bush, would you rather I do that?" And they said, "No, if you beat around the bush, we won't understand it, we won't get it." And so I have been very plain ever since. The number one complaint I have had for 40 years, started off mainly with women contacting me, was about husbands who were not interested in sex with them. And I think, Bonnie, I found your material must have been about 7 or 8 years ago. And as I have gone through a lot of your material, I can look back at those early marriages, and I am convinced that some of those wives were dealing with gay husbands. And so this has been around a long time. Once the internet kind of started firing up, and with my website, I'm now contacted by men, Christian men who are dealing with a wife who is not interested in sex. And right now, the number one Googled marriage problem is sexless marriages. And women are only slightly behind men in complaining about sexless marriages. So there is a tremendous amount of misery out there of people looking for answers and being blamed for the lack of their mate's interest in them. So this has been quite a growth journey for me. This, you know, the more I study and talk with people, the more people ask me questions I don't know the answer to. And you are real good at that, Bonnie. One reason I like to talk to you is because you ask real pointed, good questions that make me go back to square one on some things and look at them and reexamine them, and I learn from you. So that's kind of my story in a nutshell.
Well, let me bring up a few things, Patsy, so that we could, you know, really explain to people where we're coming from. First of all, you and I are close in age, and we grew up during a time in different places. I grew up on the East Coast. You're from Texas.
Right.
You came from a, you know, Christian family. I didn't. I came from a more liberal kind of a family. I lived in California for a while in the 60s and New York in the 70s. And I think that people were more open to things that were going around, but we were still pretty naive. But let's be honest, when you and I were both growing up, I didn't hear very much about homosexuality. And I really didn't know any people who admitted to me that they were gay. I mean, I heard there were rumors about this guy or another, not very often. And I always felt, oh, you know, it's a shame. Maybe they didn't have enough love from their mother, or they didn't win an orphan, you know, thinking all the wrong reasons,
right,
of course, because we didn't have information. But it would have never dawned on me, going back to the late 1970s, that somebody who was gay was going to marry somebody who was straight, because that wasn't within my realm of understanding.
Right.
So in all honesty, you know, you coming from a church kind of a family, was that something that you ever thought about?
No, I never. I remember back when the AIDS scare started, I read a book called The Unhappy Gays by Tim LaHaye. And, you know, he did not address that question. And a lot of people were real interested in the homosexual community and kind of starting to learn things. So, you know, even that exposure, the thought that some of these marriages might be the result of a woman being married to a gay man, never ever entered my thinking processes.
No, it was not something that we knew from, because I was socialized to believe, or taught to believe, and I had a liberal upbringing. Like I said, I was in California in the 1960s, where there were plenty of gay people, but the gay people were with other gay people. I mean, I had a lot of gay friends, male friends. They had boyfriends. And so that, to me, was what gay looked like. There would be no reason for me to think that somebody gay would want to marry somebody straight. But I do say in my book, you know, the Gay Husband Checklist for Women Who Wonder, I do put in there that there is, you know, a number of prototypes of women who gay men will choose from, you know, to make their wives subconsciously or consciously, either way, because those people who are trying to avoid being gay or who feel the need to get married because of pressure, they're going to seek out a wife who, you know, has some compassion for the situation or lack of understanding of it. So
yes,
one of the women that I have as a prototype are women who come from religious backgrounds, because they really don't have enough of experience to do anything.
Right.
Agree with that?
Yes, yes. Most Christians tend to look at other Christians and think, oh, they're just like me. You know, they have the same kind of attitudes I do. They try to love everybody, and they're interested in learning what the Bible teaches. And for us to, we're just totally naive about any kind of evilness or difference in other people. We just, and we're talking about people targeting these women. You know, they're not going to realize that they're targeted. Along that same line, Bonnie, one of the things we were going to talk about, and this is right along what you are saying. I recently started have a survey out there about sexless marriages and dealing with the emotional abuse that goes on with that, and I base it on 2 Timothy 3:1-5. And I've just now, I haven't been doing this very long, but I'm just now starting to get replies. And so far I have had about a third of the people who have replied are men, and the other two-thirds are women. And one of the questions I ask in here is when you got married, when you were dating, were you a victim of what we would call bait and switch? And I was surprised that 100% of the men, 100% of the women who filled this out said yes. They can look back and see during courtship their sexless spouse used bait and switch with them. And here's the questions I ask Barney, and 100% of the people checked one or more of these items. So during courtship, couldn't keep hands off of you, but cold in marriage. A good kisser, but in marriage, not interested in kissing. Said looking forward to being lovers, but in marriage, never initiates. Promised to be a passionate lover in marriage, but is a cold, mechanical lover in marriage. Sexual intimacy in courtship disappeared after marriage. And I've had one woman that I've discussed privately with this. She said she was married to a homosexual man for a while, and she said, we had sex, lots of sex before marriage. And as soon as we got married, that stopped. Another thing is they forced kissing on you in courtship, but in marriage they just want little pecks on the cheek or stiff-lipped. Passionate open mouth kissing in courtship became mechanical in marriage. Puts their arm around you only when sitting in church. Puts their arm around you only when taking pictures. And then a question I ask is that you can look back and they said something in courtship that you now realize was testing to see if you'd get upset with a sexless marriage. So, 100% of the people who have participated in this survey to this point, they can look back, and the reason I added that is a lot of times when both men and women will talk to me, they'll say, I can't understand this. When we were dating, in fact, one fellow told me, when we were dating, she couldn't keep her hands off of me. Women tell me the same thing. They say, he forced me to kiss him. I didn't want to kiss till I got married, but he forced me to kiss him. And, of course, we now know that when a man kisses a woman, especially open-mouth kissing, he is depositing testosterone into her mouth, and because of those moist membranes, she is absorbing that very quickly, and she is being turned on sexually to him. And so one woman told me she was dating a fellow who turned out to be gay, that she didn't even think anything about loving him. They dated for quite a few months before he started kissing her. And after that first night of passionate kissing, she said she went home and thought, wow, I'm in love. You know, and she had not thought that before, but she had just been given major doses of testosterone that were arousing her emotions. So this bait and switch during courtship seems to be a very common thing in these sexless marriages.
I think that a lot of it also is that when a gay man is trying to be straight, and some of them really do question their sexuality, you know, they're hoping they're not gay, and they're trying to be straight. It's not as always that they're trying to trick, you know, you, they're trying to trick Mother Nature into thinking, well, I can be straight. And, you know, when a lot of guys are younger, just about anything can turn them on. So if they can get sexually aroused by just the touch of someone, sometimes they mistake that for the possibility that they don't have to be gay, even though they have attractions to men.
Yeah.
And they're hoping, sometimes that hope is strong enough that it can arouse them thinking about, you know, possibilities of a family, of a, you know, because gay people want the same thing that straight people want. They want the same acceptance. They want to have a family. They want to have a home. Not all of them, but, you know, many of them, just like not all straight people want to get married either. But I'm saying
right.
The overwhelming majority would have, you know, if they could have picked that choice, that's the choice they would pick. And for some of them who are able to perform sexually, at least, you know, in their early years, they feel that maybe if they love someone strongly enough, maybe if they have children, that love will overtake that sexual need to be with a man. But, of course, it doesn't. And even if they don't act on it, like they're what I call dry gays. You ever hear of dry alcoholics?
Right.
Those are dry alcoholics are people who aren't drinking anymore, but they're angry and they're upset and they wish they were. You know, they still have bad behavior because they really want to be drinking. They're withstanding from it, but it doesn't mean that they're happy about it. And the same thing here. You can withhold yourself and not act on it, but it doesn't mean you're going to be kind to your family or loving to your wife or want to make love to your wife.
Right.
And I think that you've taught me more so than anyone in Christianity that God wants women to be sexually satisfied, correct?
Yes, 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 absolutely. The Bible makes no distinction between a woman and a man's ability to enjoy sex. And, in fact, in the Song of Solomon, the Shulamite maiden, she talks more about sex and looking forward to sex than her shepherd boyfriend does. And she pledges to him that she's going to be a passionate lover when they get married. And see, that's very different than the Christian background we have going back to the first few centuries when they thought anything connected with the body was nasty and that children were born of a nasty relationship between their parents and such. So the Song of Solomon's portrait of a woman being a very passionate, loving person, you know, is a very, very contradictory to what we are taught a lot of times in the various religions. And she talks about her mother. And, of course, this, you know, this is the Jewish nation there. And the Jews have always had a reputation for being not so uptight and inhibited sexually as Christian women are. The young Shulamite maiden gives her mother credit for teaching her how to satisfy a man sexually, and also that sex was for her too, that she had the right to expect to get just as much enjoyment out of it as the man did. Let me ask you a question.
I think that a lot of times within Christianity, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, now I'm not talking about today, but I'm talking about traditionally in the past, sexual activity was really looked upon for the purpose of having children versus enjoying it. Would you say that was correct?
Procreation, yes, yes, yes. It was only for having children. Back in about 1996 when I revised my book, God's People Make the Best Lovers, I had eight reasons in there that God wants you to enjoy sex. Since this new millennium, since about 2000 and maybe a little bit later, with some of these advances in MRI and SPECT scan machines, there's a lot of universities doing studies that just show the health benefits of an active sexual life. The health benefits are just phenomenal. And I have an outline that I'm working on a book. This figure's going to take me at least 2 years to get it done, probably three, called 21 Reasons God Wants You to Enjoy and Love Passionate Sex. And the reason I was able to grow from eight reasons to 21 is because I have just been studying about marriage and just have read so many of these scriptures over and over. When I read a new university study talking about, oh, here's something we discovered about sex, I think, oh, I know where that's in the Bible, you know. So I'm excited and thrilled about what science is finally learning, and these things have been in the Bible all along, and we just don't know enough about it to realize that. And a lot of what their research is the benefit of hormones. The sharing of hormones in the sexual act is physically and emotionally healthy for both the husband and the wife. The wife absorbing the man's semen within her vagina, that affects her estrogen and her other feminine hormones. She gets a lot of really good, just health benefits. The other day I read something that when a couple is having, if they're having sex three times a week, the health benefits from that will knock 10 years off of your appearance. Now, see, that's a whole lot more fun than going and having some kind of surgery to improve your appearance. So God intended for husbands and wives to have a real active sex life, and he has put all of these benefits in there. Not only are they expressing love and enjoying the hormones that are making them more affectionate towards each other, sex protects the heart. There are no drugs that these drug companies can come up with that begin to compare with an active sex life for protecting both a man and a woman from heart attacks, from stroke, and even cancer. So it is just absolutely amazing what these scientists are continuing to discover about the benefits of an active sex life.
Patsy, I'm just curious. You came up with some revolutionary new thoughts that I have never heard before till I met you. And I know that, you know, I've read some of your books because you have a wonderful collection of books that we'll talk about in a moment. Are there other people within the Christian community that are kind of moving in your direction, do you think?
There's
still a rebel in your own time.
There is some of them. I read their material, and the number one difference I find in myself and other Christian women is I really push for a vaginal orgasm. I have been teaching women how to enjoy a vaginal orgasm for 40 years, and it's something you share with your husband. It increases his pleasure. It increases the woman's pleasure. And what I see in a lot of these Christian websites promoting Christian sex, they are pushing the clitoral orgasm. And for any woman such as myself who has enjoyed both kinds, there is no comparison between a vaginal orgasm. And the vaginal orgasm has got a bad name. People say it's a myth. And if you really study the Song of Solomon, I talk about that. I have an appendices in my Song of Solomon book on the vaginal orgasm. Because if you model the attitudes, one thing you see in the way the Shulamite and the shepherd treated each other that you do not find in sexless marriages is that they knew how to compliment each other. And women tell me and men tell me both how they are starved for a real compliment. And when you analyze the Song of Solomon, you see the compliments that the shepherd paid the Shulamite. He's creating an emotional relationship with her. He values her as a person. She is an entrepreneur. She is working in the vineyard. She is handling money. At the end of the Song of Solomon, she pays the highest government official, who is King Solomon, for renting his land. She pays the workers. And she is probably 13 years old. And anybody who, you know, I wasn't always a farm girl, but when I was in high school, my dad started farming, and I have that history. And then my dad was a farmer until he died. So farm people understand that 13-year-old girls and boys can be out there supervising farmhands and making decisions like that. So she's a very capable person. She's not some meek stay-at-home person. She is out in the field supervising. The story tells us she wasn't a worker as much as she was a supervisor. And the shepherd appreciated that. He paid her real compliments. So, and when you model those characteristics, the vaginal orgasm takes place in the brain. It's an attitude, and And it's not just the woman, not just her fault. Well, if you can't have it, it's all your fault. God, it does not believe in spectator sport type sex. Both the man and the woman have to be fully intellectually, emotionally, and sexually involved with each other. And when they do, when they surrender to each other, then all it takes is practice, and that's going to happen. You know, in the Old Testament, God told the young man, when you get married, you spend the first year at home. You don't have a traveling job. You don't get in the army. You stay home, and who are you giving pleasure to? It's your wife. It doesn't tell the wife to give pleasure to the husband. It tells the husband to give pleasure for the wife. And if they're practicing and just loving each other, I mean, that's all it takes. It takes love and practice and lots of sex, and it is going to be a natural response for any couple, and they are just going to delight in enjoying that for themselves.
Well, that works for couples that are not in our situation. In our situation, that's just not happening. So
right.
I would like to talk a little bit about how you feel with this, and if you don't mind me reading a few things that you've written, because
okay.
Patsy is just a beautiful, beautiful writer, and when I was reading some of her words, which she's more than happy to send to you, you know, I'll give you all that information when we finish, and I'll have it in our newsletter. Some of this really hurt me, and not hurt me personally, but just made me hurt for you. And it's an issue that is very, very much on all of our minds, and it's about the children. And
yeah.
Patsy acknowledges when you have marriages like ours, there's lots of complications. She has a whole thing here written on this now. And when it says, you know, she's very easy and fast to say, don't make the mistakes that I did, because Patsy was in a marriage where there was also a lack of real, you know, love that was involved, so the children didn't have role modeling. And, you know, some of the things that she wrote about... Okay, like many of you, I thought I could love my children enough for two parents. I didn't know that the spouse doesn't know how to love the mate, that he or she can't possibly know how to nurture and cherish the children. I didn't know children as young as two are impacted by an unloving parent. By that age, the tender-hearted ones are already headed towards becoming an appeasing codependent with the unloving parent. Others take out their frustrations by modeling the abusive parent to turn into bullying narcissist. Now I tell men and women in unloving marriages, your children are too old and you are too young to allow this problem to continue. It's past the time to deal with an unloving home. I didn't know that children commonly blame the loving parent for not protecting them. And who else would protect them? The self-absorbed promoter of a sexless marriage is busy causing problems instead of creating love in the home. Many of these adult children move across the country to make a clean break from the dysfunction of home of origin. I now tell parents, step out of your pain and into your children's misery so you can make healthy decisions for them and for you. Like many of you, my children never experienced their mother's true personality growing up. Trying to survive in a loveless, sexless marriage so saps us, we are never emotionally free to be our best. And because of my childhood spent trying to keep an angry mother happy and my marriage to a man I could never please, I thought I was born without a sense of humor. I didn't realize I was existing in survival mode and in a state of low-grade depression. Even before my divorce finalized, I was thrilled to discover I have a wonderful genetic sense of humor. I laugh out loud easily and often. I so regret that my children didn't grow up with their true mother. We should have been laughing fools. My children suffered 1,000 times more than I ever did. This is my greatest ignorance and sorrow that still makes me cry, that I didn't step out of my own pain to see theirs. I was the adult and could make my own choices. They depended on me to protect them. My son carried his scars to an early grave. My daughter and I talk about her wounds. I've apologized many times for my blindness to her pain. My children fail to receive the greatest gift parents can give them, to genuinely love and cherish each other and them. So why did I live in denial and think I was working the problem as best as I could solve it? because it wasn't until after my father died in 2006 that I was forced to study narcissism. I finally started examining my home of origin and learning that what true love looks, smells, and feels and tastes like and sounds like and acts like. I began by healing my own childhood hurts and giving up my childish way of hunkering down in survival mode before abuse. As I put away my childish ways, my eyes opened up to my marriage mistakes and my children's sufferings. So that was a very, very hard to read kind of statements from you, because I think many of us go through that same kind of thought process where we're thinking, you know, it's better to stay married and to break up a marriage, and even a bad marriage is better than no marriage. And I think that we grew up with that kind of thinking. I know that when my parents divorced back in 1966, they were one of the first people divorced in my whole community. You know, I was the first stigma child. People didn't break up, you know, dysfunctional homes back then. They just lived, learned to live in them and stay dysfunctional with them. But when, you know, you get into a marriage, and I guess what hurts so much is that some of our women linger for years and years and years thinking they're doing the right thing by the children, so their children won't come from a broken home. But one of the sayings that Dr. Phil always, you know, I quote him on, it's better to come from a broken home than live in a broken home. And I really do believe that. But I think the part that hit me so much, what you said, is that your true personality is never able to evolve when you're in survival mode, because you're just trying to get through the day. You totally lose who you are because you're not receiving the kind of nourishment and the cherishment, you know, cherishing that a person needs in order to grow and thrive in a marriage. Would you say that's pretty much true?
Yes, you're always walking on eggshells, and so are your children. And when you're hunkered down like that, you just, you know, like I said, and I will tell your listeners that I stayed in a sexless marriage for 46 years. And one of the reasons I did was because I thought we were spiritual soulmates, and I realized,
yeah,
you know that we were not. The only person who was fooled in that was me. And
were you
when
fooling yourself on that one, do you think?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, my ex was a preacher. I was working with women and marriages, and I was seeing God's word just transform a lot of marriages, and I knew the problem was not God. And I thought that I worked real hard to learn. I thought I was imitating the Apostle Paul, working real hard to be content within the station of where I had found myself. So I worked very hard for that. And I will tell your listeners too, one thing I did was I worked real hard to turn off my sexual desires. And I was successful for a little while, and then I realized that I was losing the ability to love my children, and that was not a solution. And so then I had to work hard to go back to where I could, the love for my children could flow freely. And I thought I was learning to be content within, you know, with the station of where I was. I did not realize I was submitting to sin, and that is one of the things that I have finally realized in working with these sexless marriages and on this survey that I have out. That's what I'm doing. I am using as a basis 2 Timothy 3, verses through 5, where it has a list of 19 characteristics of people who are without natural affection. And we make the mistake of thinking without natural affection is a characteristic of homosexuals. That is very limiting. It is talking about anybody, men or women, who do not have the ability to love their family. That is it regarding love of family. And they are very selfish. They are narcissistic. And that's what I'm seeing on this survey of people who have already filled it out. Every one of them, when I ask them, did you grow up in a narcissistic home, about 67% said yes. Then when I gave them characteristics of a narcissistic parent, 100% of them are checking some of those things. So they've all grown up in this defective home, just like I did. I grew up with a screaming mother who was very punishing, and we don't have the ability. We don't know what true love really looks like. And you know, I went through your five senses and acts like, because true love is what we learn from the Song of Solomon. It affects our five senses. Then what I see on this survey, I ask them questions about what they're living with their husband. This is under the section on without natural affection. And I put the same characteristics under the mate, whether it's the husband or the wife, but in our case we're talking about husbands, that I put under a narcissistic parent. And 100% of the people who have responded so far, and I realize we just have a small sampling, checked one or more of those characteristics. What they did was they grew up in a home that was dysfunctional. It was not normal. And they married a person with those same dysfunctional characteristics that they grew up with, but they did not know enough about life to realize these were not normal characteristics. They essentially married someone exactly like the narcissistic parent. And
I think that's very common, you know, that people marry what they're familiar with.
Yes.
And, you know, whatever you see in your home. I know that a number of the women who are part of our support network came from families where there was dysfunction. And sometimes, you know, when somebody drops you some kind words, you know, you're only dealing with crumbs your whole life. And somebody's dropping you a cookie, and even though that cookie's going to crumble, it still looks good at the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just gravitate to somebody who wants you and to makes you feel that you're special. And you can't look beyond that because you just don't know what to look for because you haven't grown up
right.
in a kind of home. You know, when people have loving, caring parents, they try to replicate that in their own relationships later on.
Right.
But when you've never
right.
had that, then you're just repeating and you're not going based on any particular experience. I just wanted to say a couple of other things that you wrote, Patsy, because this piece is powerful to me. And you wrote, like many of you, I'm the adult child of a narcissistic home. My mother was a screaming, punishing narcissist. I didn't know what true love looked, sounded, smelled, tasted, felt, and acted like for a woman who was in love and clueless to how emotionally defective and dysfunctional both the courtship and my marriage were. I didn't come from a loving home of origin to be able to choose wisely. I believed the shame and the blame heaped upon me. I didn't know that blaming the mate is the number one game unloving spouses play on the mate who complains about a lack of sexual love. Like many of you, the blame started on the honeymoon. I said, my spouse is perfect for me. It's perfect except for sex. I didn't understand that a sexless marriage is a 24/7 relationship problem. A dead bedroom is just the most obvious symptom of daytime character defects. Consequently, I didn't try to solve the right problems. Like many of you, I didn't know the lack of sex wasn't about me. I didn't know that sexual problems nearly always start in childhood. The spouse brings them to the marriage on one day. Usually these insidious sexual inhibitions began shaping the relationship during the courtship. The red flags flew right past me. I worked hard to be a better lover. I read Dr. Marie Robinson's book, The Power of Sexual Surrender, and began responding quickly with vaginal orgasms, but I cried myself to sleep from constant rejection. Like many wives who become better lovers, it actually made the problem worse. And I think that, you know, you were very open about saying that, and I think it takes a lot of courage to be honest about it, because a lot of our women who are living in sexless marriages, which are almost all of them, they go through all those phases of self-blame, of, you know, blaming themselves for the lack of it. And their husbands often will not disagree with them. They're not saying, oh, no, honey, it's not you, it's me. They're saying, yep, there must be something wrong with you, or you don't smell good, or you're too aggressive, or you're too demanding, or, you know, you're always thinking about sex, you're like a nymphomaniac. I know that that's the one thing that hurts women so badly when they have a normal sex drive. And yet their husbands are looking to run away from them and not be with them, which to me is not a natural thing in most cases. Would you say that's true?
Right. Yes, yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things I appreciated about your books, Bonnie, is that you tell women what normal heterosexual love is like. You give examples of what it's like to be with the man who really likes women and enjoys women. He kisses her totally differently than a man in a sexless marriage kisses his wife. Yeah, I mean, and that's something so little. You know, these people, they complain about they never get touched. I mean, you don't ever get he never initiates a hug or reaches out and touches your hand unless you're in church, and then he puts his arm around you to, you know, when everybody's, oh, what a nice looking,
lovely
couple.
Make a big show, right.
Yes, pretend. And I've just had lots of women tell me that, you know, the only time he ever puts his arm around me is in church. There's no cuddling at home, no sitting with his arm around you watching television or listening to music or, you know, something like that. So,
well, you know what it is also, Patty? It's not so much just a lack of the sexual, you know, in the sense. There's no intimacy that's been built up.
Yes.
Because
yes.
With straight men, when you're having lovemaking, and I won't call it sex, when you're having lovemaking, it's different than sex. You do build up intimacy because then things do come up. Some partner could get sick. You may not be able to have any sexual relationships for a while, but you've built up enough intimacy that you can lay with each other, hold each other, and even though it's not exactly having a sexual encounter, you have that intimacy there to build on. When you're having a husband who doesn't want to be with you and is looking for a million reasons not to, you're not building that intimacy.
Right.
You know, there's no touching and feeling that kind of compassion and love for the person. A few of the things I want people to know about you, besides the fact that you do coaching for Christian women to help them through their divorces when they have to make the hard decisions of leaving their marriages, which a lot of our Christian women have a difficult time in dealing with. But you've been working with marriages for over 40 years, coaching Christian marriages. But you also have a number of books out, plus you have a free newsletter that I look forward to, which is called Embarrass the Alligator. And can you tell people why you named it that?
Yes. Actually, I got that name from a preacher friend who said that a lot of times couples are having problems and they don't go to get help until they're sitting in his office and the man is sitting there. He is sobbing because his wife's on the way out the door and she is hard as stone. And the only reason he's there then is because she finally did something that was so outrageous that it would embarrass an alligator. She finally got his attention, but she was so worn out emotionally. She was so past being willing to work on that marriage that now she has his attention and it's too late. And there's really no hope for that relationship. So I named it Embarrass the Alligator because when you're dealing with serious marriage problems, sometimes you need to do something so outrageous as to get the other person's attention that, look, this marriage is in trouble, and if we don't solve this problem, it's not going to survive, and it's past time to solve the marriage problems. Because what I see in every one of these sexless marriages and the responses to this survey where the people are giving me the stats for how long they've been married and in these marriages, it is going to get worse. And a lot of times women think, you know, if it doesn't get any worse than this, I can handle it. I mean, I've been there. If it doesn't get any worse than this, I can handle it. Well, it's going to get worse. That's just the way it is. At some point, he's going to become impotent with his wife because it takes tremendous emotional energy to keep pretending, to keep blaming her, and it's just easy to feign some kind of medical condition, say, hey, look, I medically can't have sex anymore, so that's the end of that. I have a friend who has had a very loving marriage, and her husband is a diabetic. And their relationship is such that they still hug, they still kiss, and he tells her at times, he says, I really miss that part of our life together. And she says, yeah, me too. Well, in a sexless marriage, that's not the way it is. It becomes more lonely than ever. And, in fact, one of the questions I have on this survey is, when your hormones have slowed down, you're not climbing the wall with frustration and just overwhelmed with unsatisfied desires. When your hormones slow down, are you lonelier than ever? And people are saying, yes, yes. My hormones have slowed down and I can live without sex easier, but there's no emotional bond between us, no touching, no genuine caring. And so I'm not, don't remember quite where I was headed with that story.
Well, that's okay. I do want to let women know, though, that, you know, if you go to Patsy's website at patsyraydawson.com, and I'll have that in my newsletter, but it's P-A-T-S-Y Ray R-A-E Dawson, D-A-W-S-O-N.com. Patsy offers lots of wonderful things on here, including, you know, her free newsletter where you can sign up. And it's a very interesting newsletter all of the time, and you can see Patsy's beautiful picture. And also, Patsy has a list of all of her books here, and you've written a number of books, and I know that you've updated them and revised them. But I think what's important is that so many women who are Christian really suffer with, you know, that commitment that they made in front of God, that they promised to love and to cherish for better, for worse, and rich or poor, till death do we part. And what I say to Christian women and to other women, you know, from other religions who also took wedding vows, is it's true that you did take those vows, but part of the vows were never, you know, it's in sickness and health or rich or poor. It didn't say for straight or for gay. And that wasn't part of the, you know, wedding vow. That was something that was brought into the marriage without your having any understanding or knowledge of it, and that you don't have to feel committed to stay in a marriage that isn't meant to be, because it really isn't meant for gay people to be married to straight people. And this is not what God, in my opinion, would have wanted for anybody to have to suffer through. How do you feel about that?
Well, what I
on a personal
started,
level.
Okay, what I've started telling people is that God wants you to love and enjoy passionate sex. And if you do not understand how much God loves passionate sex, it is something that originated in his mind. He designed all these health-benefiting hormones and exercises that are released during the sexual act for the benefit of husbands and wives. And I say, if you don't understand that, you don't understand why God hates divorce. God himself is divorced from Israel, and what we call scriptural reasons for divorce have to do with the sexual relationship. But because we are so inhibited sexually and don't understand how much God loves passionate sex, we draw lines, boundaries for people that are not in the Bible. One of the oldest, and I'm going to say one of, I kind of suspect it may be the oldest, but I haven't verified that. One of the oldest marriage problems in the Bible was a sexless marriage. And that was talking about a slave girl who was given to a man, to her master, to be a wife, and he was not fulfilling his sexual duties to her. And it talks about her divorcing him because she is in a sexless marriage. So sexless marriages are one of the oldest marriage problems of the Bible, and the solution was divorce to get away from them. And it's interesting to me that the verses, and it's in Exodus 21, 7 through 11, if someone wants to look that up, it doesn't contemplate why the marriage is sexless. It doesn't matter how many wives he has. It does not matter. She has a right to sexual fulfillment and enjoyment with that husband. And if he's not there for her, she has the right to divorce him. Now, people will come back and say, well, women couldn't divorce in the Old Testament. Well, maybe they couldn't in the same way a man could, but they could go before the elders at the gate at the city and say, look, this is the way my husband is treating me, and I want you to put pressure on him to divorce me. And they would do that. There was a way for her to be divorced. And when you go back and look at the history of divorce since Christ died, you see at different times in history, religious people have recognized that a sexless marriage was a reason for, a scriptural reason for divorce. And I believe that principle is also taught in the New Testament. You and I have tried to talk about, get down into the nitty-gritty aspects of divorce before, Bonnie, and it's just too big a topic for an hour program. And one thing I do coaching on is the Bible's teaching about divorce in regard to sexless marriages. I tell people all the time, God does not trap anyone in a sexless marriage. Our ignorance of how important passionate sex is to God, our ignorance of God's laws and teaching about divorce, that's what traps us. We just don't have all the facts to make the right decision. So, you know, I'm available to discuss that with somebody in more detail and to sit down and look at the scriptures together and talk about the word meanings and the applications, because this is something I think both the Old and New Testament are very clear on. God does not trap anyone in a sexless marriage.
Well, one of the things I just want to let our listeners know, because we're coming to an end of our time, is that my newsletter will be coming out this week in a few days, and you'll be able to read some of Patsy's information and get her information where to go to as far as calling her or getting in touch with her for, you know, coaching. If you're a Christian woman and you're looking to leave your marriage and you feel conflicted because of your upbringing and your religious beliefs, you know, we have also Suzette Hinton Vernon, who comes on here every month as my co-host, who also came from a very different background of, you know, Southern Baptist, who had to go through it. Patsy, of course, you know, is a coach as far as, you know, Christian learnings towards it, and they'll all tell you that life was not meant to be this complicated, that you have to do what's best for you. But I really appreciate Patsy's heartfelt words, and she's happy to send you out, you know, her little information brochure. You know, I'll give that information to you in my upcoming newsletter about how it did affect her family and how it did affect her children. Because while we think we're protecting them, we're really not protecting them by setting the wrong example, because they do model themselves after us and they do repeat what they see at home. And one of the women in our group tonight, I'll just say this real quickly, was upset because her daughter was disrespecting her. And, you know, a few of us told, you know, they practice what they see at home. If they have a husband who doesn't respect you and who disrespects you, they're going to treat you the same way, even though you can be the most loving mother in the world. But a lot of it revolves around how your husband will treat you. And a lot of these men are very frustrated. They don't want to be in the marriage with you. You know, they feel trapped, so they're not treating you very nicely. And Patsy will definitely be able to walk you through that. So, Patsy, I just want to thank you so much for coming here tonight and sharing your story and sharing your ability to work with women to help them get past any problems that they're having as far as coming to a decision that makes sense for them and for their children. And I know that, you know, I've known Patsy for many years. I've met her in person. I've listened to her shows, worked with her on different projects, and I know if I were a Christian and I needed advice, she is one woman who I would trust my soul with, because I know she would never lead me wrong, and she would only lead me down the path to having a happier life. So she has my 100% endorsement of everything good, and hopefully some of you who are floundering now or in the future will, you know, reach out to Patsy, and she's a wonderful, wonderful coach. And she can send you all those details once you have her website, patsyraydawson.com, and you'll be getting the information in my newsletter, or feel free to write to me at bonkaye, @AOL.com. Well, Patsy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having
shining a light on a topic that's really difficult for people.
Yeah, no. Well, I hope the more we can get this out in the open and talk about it, that we can help people move on from such a miserable relationship. And when they do move on, it just blesses their children. So,
And I'm hoping that you'll come back in a few months and we can talk more about this, because there's so much to talk about.
Okay.
All right.
I would love to do that. So.
That'll be wonderful. Plan for you before the holidays. That'll be my holiday treat. All right. Well, I love you, Patsy, and love to all of our women. Love to you, Scott, if you're listening. And hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll be back with you again soon. Have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.